You might think that connecting economics with suicide bombers is drawing a bit of a long bow. Well, pay attention, because now on Life Matters we're going to talk about terrorism and how to prevent it in a new way. And surprisingly, garbage services have something to do with this. Andrew Lee relishes new ways of thinking, and he joins me now for our first Right Side Economics this year. Andrew is Professor of Economics at the Australian National University. Hello, welcome back.
Good morning, Richard.
Using the tools of economics to understand terrorist attacks, how does that work?
Well, one way of thinking about suicide bombers is that they're responding to the set of incentives that we offer them. So one of the big puzzles in the world is why there were essentially no suicide bombings back in the 1970s, but probably there's going to be about 10,000 lives lost to suicide bombers in the 2000s. And so economists have said, well, you know, one way is just to throw your hands up in the air and say this is all about crazy people. But another approach is to say, well, what's changed over this time? What is it that developed countries are doing differently in countries where terrorists are active? And Eli Berman, who's a fantastic young professor at University of California, San Diego, says what's different is that the forces that we send in have gotten harder. It's when you send in an armoured personnel carrier, it's very hard for a poorly equipped, poorly trained insurgent to do very much about that. So they turn to the only weapon they have left, suicide bombing.
It's not. We tend to think of suicide bombers as being religious fanatics, but I think he points out that actually the big user in a way, the people who kind of led the way, which is an awful way to put it, on suicide bombing, were the Tamil Tigers, who were not religious, not in an overt way, anyway.
Indeed. So the Tamil Tigers are nominally Marxist. And Berman says that there's the Tamil example. There's also examples that you get when you interview the friends and family of successful suicide bombers, or if you interview failed suicide bombers themselves. Religion doesn't loom so high. The sorts of issues that they talk about are protecting their community, protecting their friends and family. Berman says we should think of suicide bombers as misguided altruists and stop trying to pin all the attacks on those poor 72 virgins.
Because a lot of the thinking has been, well, apart from that, a lot of the thinking has been, well, look, if you can just, I suppose, this is about poverty. This is about people who haven't got enough. This is about people who are angry because of that. So what we've got to try and do is reduce the poverty. You and Eli Berman are saying, no, that's not it. It's more complicated.
Yes, though poverty certainly has something to do with it. But the way that poverty plays in is that countries which are very poor tend to be countries with bad social service provision. And when there's a gap, when the state steps back, that gives room for other actors to step in. So Hamas collects garbage. Hezbollah set up health clinics. The Taliban in Afghanistan run law courts. All things that are done in developed countries by well-functioning governments. But when there's a gap, these organisations step in to fill it. And these social service provisions are important to terrorist organisations in a number of ways. They allow them to recruit new members, to test their mettle. Are you really committed to Hamas? Are you really willing to pick up garbage for us for a year? Mm-hmm. And also they give you leverage over the local population. So you can easily say to the local population, if you inform on us, then we're just simply going to take the garbage collection away next week. So social service provision, Berman argues, is inextricably tied up with the way that many terrorist groups do their business.
That then surely suggests that this is a target for people who are trying to combat terrorism. If you can move in to providing those social services, and of course it becomes a slightly circular argument, doesn't it? Because if you want to do that, you need to have security, first of all. But if you can do that, then you start to take away the rug from underneath the terrorist groups.
Absolutely. So this is David Kilcullen, the Australian Army expert, talks about counterinsurgency as being armed social work. And what he means by that is that this is not the sexy part of military operations. This is not the drone strikes blowing things up and guys with big guns racing into houses and shooting a lot of people. This is just the slow chipping away at the support base that holds up these terrorist organisations.
The other thing, of course, that you would have to do if you want to get rid of or at least reduce their ability to hurt you with terrorist organisations is cut off or reduce their money supply.
That's absolutely right. And so there's some simple ways you could think about doing that. Certainly terrorist organisations disproportionately get money from petroleum and from hard drugs. So, for example, if you legalise drugs or if you struck a climate change deal that saw us reduce our dependence on petroleum, those would be straightforward ways of reducing the amount of dollars flowing to terrorist groups.
I saw a very interesting argument a year or so ago, Andrew, that NATO should buy the opium crop in Afghanistan. It could be used to address the worldwide shortage of morphine and morphine-based drugs, and that would take the Taliban out of the equation at the same time.
Absolutely. So you want to reduce the dollars that are flowing through these organisations and try and cut them back to groups that are operating out of caves and aren't integrated into local population. Those groups can still do damage, of course. They still have adherents who will be rusted on regardless of whether you've got a local population. But really being able to bring down governments relies on an organisation that has a sort of deep embeddedness in the community and is awash with cash.
On Life Matters Today, it's the first Rightside Economics of the year, and Professor Andrew Lee, who's a Professor of Economics at the ANU, is with me in the studio for the first time. We're talking about the connection between economics and terrorism. Now, this is fairly new thinking, isn't this, Andrew? How much is it starting to impact on, say, how the United States reacts in places like Afghanistan?
I think it's been increasingly important. Certainly Kilcullen's work has been highly influential. And it does represent, in some sense, a second wave of thinking about the economics of terrorism. So an early approach had very much focused on individuals rather than groups. Princeton's Alan Kruger obtained a series of very interesting data sets in which he was able to show that the perpetrators of terrorist acts were disproportionately better educated and perhaps even richer than the communities from which they came. And so Kruger concluded from that, well, poverty is not the answer. So this isn't about social policy. This is about taking out the leadership. What's nice about this the second wave approach, Eli Berman's approach, is it says, well, you've got to think about the structures, the groups, the way in which these organisations are held up. Sure, those at the top tend to be better educated, just as the typical politician in any given country is better educated than the average citizen. But that doesn't mean that you can't bring down the organisation through a sort of social service provision.
The other thing that economists talk about, and we've talked about a few times on this show, is incentives. Can a country like the United States use incentives in a country like Afghanistan to try and, pull out a block or two from the Taliban?
Absolutely. And so we've increasingly, the coalition forces in Afghanistan have increasingly been thinking about ways in which they can create jobs which pay a little better than the Taliban is paying. So it's important for us, for example, to find out what the going wage is for a Taliban fighter and try and create a better and safer job than that. And a job in which the person can really feel they're looking after their local community. And, you know, this is being done stealthily in Afghanistan. The best example we have, oddly, is President Nasser's taking over the Muslim Brotherhood's social service provision in the 1950s. Muslim Brotherhood were threatening the Egyptian state quite considerably, and Nasser's approach was simply to nationalise all of their schools, health clinics and so on, and essentially pull the rug straight out from under them.
What about Al-Qaeda? Now, as far as I know, they don't provide rubbish collection or childcare or anything. Surely you can't take this approach with them.
So that's certainly right. This is an approach which works well for Hezbollah, it works for Hamas, it works for the Al-Sadr Martyrs Brigade. It works less well for Al-Qaeda, who is to a large extent in remote areas. The Taliban, though, is increasingly trying to compete on the social service front, and so potentially it applies to the Taliban as well. I wouldn't say that Berman's approach answers every terrorist problem, but I think it takes us 80% of the way there, because, as he's able to show, most terrorist organisations have a social service provision base.
Andrew, it's always interesting. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Richard.
Andrew Lee is an economist in the Research School of Economics at the Australian National University, and he joins us each Tuesday fortnight, which is a new time for Rightside Economics. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Richard Addy.